Welcome. Thank you for being my guest this afternoon.
My pleasure.
It's been, I've been wanting to have you as a guest for a long time. You grew up in Arkansas, right?
Yes.
You were born in Arkansas and grew up there.
Born in Arkansas, grew up there, went to high school there.
It was the center, in many ways, of the Jim Crow. At the era that you were growing up, there was strong Jim Crow legislation in Arkansas. How did that affect you? Did you go to a segregated school? Did you have to live that way? And was it a conscious way of living, or was it that the way everybody lived, and so that's the way that it is?
That's the way it was in that time. If you remember, when Arbor Farber stepped in the schoolhouse from Little Rock, and I lived about 4 blocks from Central High, but I had to walk all the way across town to a school called Dunbar, because we were not allowed to even go to school there. And we didn't have a football field or nothing like that, so we would have to do our football playing on Monday nights, because the fact that was the only time that they would allow our school to play football in the stadium, because Little Rock High had the stadium and we didn't have anything, so that's where we were. So you grew up under the Jim Crow situation. That was the way of life. There was no ifs, ands, and buts about it.
Yeah, the Little Rock, Arkansas desegregation was 1957.
Right.
And you were born well before that.
A long time.
So you were going to school. You were going to grade school. You went to high school in segregated facilities.
That's the way it was. And you know, you had the bus. You had to get you were not allowed to on the bus. They were only allowed. You were only allowed 10 seats on the bus, and when those seats were full, you had to stand. Even though there were some empty spaces on the bus, there was a line across the bus that you could not stand beyond that line. And so sometimes the bus would have maybe 10 people in the front part of it, but there's only 12 or 14 of us standing in the back trying to use the bus. So it was segregated.
And it must have been extremely frustrating for someone such as yourself to have to experience that.
Well, at that age, and you didn't recognize that there were going to be any changes, because there was nothing in the works to make any changes. So everybody was in that same depressed area, you know. So that's the way we had to live.
Did you know your grandfather?
I knew my grandfather. My grandfather. I knew him real well. As a matter of fact, I used to, when I was a young kid, smaller than that, when I was 9 years old, I was learning. He taught me how to drive. He's the only one who had a car. And so then I got to the point that I could drive when I was 10 and 11. I could drive into town. We were 17 miles from town, so I could drive the Model T into town, because he would go to the white barbershop. My grandfather was Jewish background, and his hair was is the same color as yours. Pardon my
what
sentence.
Little I have
what,
left.
What little you have left. Yeah. And so,
but you don't have that much left.
I neither. No, that's right. But my grandfather had a good big head of hair, you know, and so he would go to the white barbershop to get his hair cut. And when I drive him into town with my little friend in there, because it was a stretch for us, and we would have to sit on the floor and while he was in the barbershop, you know, because we wouldn't stand on the streets. And then the white farmers come in, they knew him, Doc, how you doing? So, and he said, oh, you're real nice to those little nigger kids. But they didn't realize that he was our grandfather, and the white farmers would throw us money for candy and stuff like that, you know. So growing up like that, my grandfather said, look, always, whatever you do, always be nice to everybody. Someday you will understand what I'm telling you. But always be nice. Don't fight nobody. If you have to, walk away. Don't fight nobody and don't hurt nobody. And whatever you do, don't kill anybody. And my grandfather taught me that from an early age, and I've never forgotten that.
But your grandfather at one time was a slave, is that correct?
Yes, he was. Yeah. And he was freed, but he was set free by the farmer that was the slave master. But he was set free because of the fact that he was a different color than the rest of us, rest of them was. So then he went out of Mississippi. He said he walked and ran and did everything he did to stay out of the way of everybody. So he found a place in Arkansas. And at that time, he could homestead. So he found a place and he homesteaded. Because the fact that he was not as black as the other people, he didn't have no problem going in, filing a homestead claim. So the Gibson farm became a homesteading farm because every chance he had, he was homesteading the next property right next to him, next to him. So he wound up with 300 acres of land down there in the good country. And he said it was small. When I was a kid growing up, they were still cutting trees and bulldozing trees down so you could enlarge the farm. So it's a history in itself. You know,
It must have been remarkable hearing him tell stories.
Yeah.
When you were growing up,
a remarkable man to be with him that length of time and see how he would know how to deal with people.
Obviously, the lessons stuck because you became known as you moved into the to the city council as a facilitator and as a unifier.
Right.
So his lessons stuck.
Yeah, he did.
Is that why you didn't become bitter when you? As you grew older and you found that there was a world much wider and much different than the one that you were living in Arkansas, is he one of the reasons why you didn't become angry?
He is one of the reasons. And, you know, and the thing about it, when you come into being and you can see how you can facilitate with people because you were taught at an early age as to how to handle people, how to smile and how to be nice and how to be kind to people, because that's the way he taught me, you know, from an early age. So coming up through this Everett and all of these things, it made me a mind-boggling person because I was always wanting to make sure that I left a smile on everybody's face as I met them, you know, because that was the way I was taught. And I would have fun doing it because the fact that a lot of people were not relating to me because of my color, but I could look at them and smile because I knew what was on their mind because the fact that I didn't have no anger in my mind, but I can feel the anger in theirs and the lack of respect that they have when I'm talking to them. You know, people don't understand that you can look at a person and tell almost read their mind. And when you get into that, where you need that in order to be able to raise your family and comfort your family, then you learn how to read people's thoughts. And, you know, so it's a way of life for me.
And we're talking with Carl Gibson here on Sound Living this afternoon, and you're welcome to join the conversation at 425-303-9074. Did the light-skinned nature of your grandfather pass to your father?
No, it passed to one of his sons. That the rest of them, my father is dark like I am. But he had two sons, and one of the sons transferred to him, but it didn't to my father and my uncle. But I had one uncle that was his white skin and hair. Everything was transferred to him.
And your parents, what did they contribute to your growing up? Was it them that instilled you a feeling, the need, the necessity to get the education, to continue to school and get the education?
That all came from my mother. My father was a guy that didn't talk too much. And I was an only son. And so my mother then became my best friend. My father and I didn't talk that much when I was growing up.
Not that unusual.
Yeah, no, not that unusual. But my mother said to me that when I was 7 years old, we had to work in the field and planting and chopping cotton and stuff like that. My mother then taught me then how to cook. As a seven-year-old kid, then I had to go home, and she would lay it out, and I'd have to go in and start cooking. Because we ate at heavy meals at noon. Because the hot sun, you'd have to take some time out in the, at the middle of the mid-morning, because the sun was so hot. So then you go back in the afternoon later. And my mother said, look, I'm going to teach you how to cook. Now, you got to understand what I'm teaching you. Don't you have to stay in the field? So it didn't, you know, so then I learned then how to cook. And so all of my three sons had to learn how to cook when they were young so that they could be able to take care of themselves or take care of their families or whatever they needed to do. So my father was a handicapped. And so he couldn't work that much in the field, but he was a good man, you know.
So what's your best meal? What's the best thing that you could cook?
Oh, I can do a pretty good job frying some chicken.
We're talking with Carl Gibson this afternoon on Sound Living. We're going to take a brief break, and we're going to continue with our conversation with him as we move into Everett with the Carl Gibson, a 24-year veteran of the Everett City Council, first elected in 1971, and he was 24 years on the Everett City Council. I have a suspicion from what you were talking about that Arkansas is a good place to be from. It's not a good place to be living in, at least in that era.
In that area, it wasn't a good place to be.
So how did you get out of Arkansas?
Well, I had to get off the farm. I excuse me, was married in 1972, and my wife and I then went to the farm to stay for 1 year because my father had said that he would give us 5 acres of land to start our family with in that. And so we worked that year, and I thought that we were going to make, we had 5 bales of cotton, so we, my wife and I, was happy because we had a little stake, we thought. And so then what happened when the father finally sold the cotton, then he said to me, he said, you know, I paid gas for the tractor, and I paid to give you some money. You loan you some money one time. But anyway, I said, okay. So he gave us $200. Now, that was a whole year's work. So then I told my wife, I said, we're going to leave. We can't do this. So I told my mother, I said, well, we're leaving. My wife is going into Little Rock to stay, and I'm going to California to get a job because we're not going to stay on the farm. We can't do that. So we left and went to Richmond, California. I worked in the shipyard there and then got into the Navy from there.
You joined the Navy?
No, they joined me.
Okay, fair enough.
Yeah. So then they sent me to Bremerton. So what am I going to do in Bremerton? Then that was where my duty station was first time. So we got after about 2 months there, then they sent me to Whidbey Island. That's supposed to be my rear duty station begin from then on. So I got to Whidbey Island, and the chief of the wardroom didn't like me for some unknown reason, because I guess I came from some part of the country. But anyway, he sent me to work up to the captain's house. That's supposed to be the worst job that you could have, working for the captain. But when I got up there, because I had worked so much during coming to school, high school, and hotels and places like that, so I knew how to treat people. So the captain's wife then found out that I had a wife, and so she said, "You bring your wife in." So she found out that we couldn't get no closer to Whidbey Island than Everett. And so then she said, "Well, that's fine. I will make sure that you get home 4 nights a week. Now, that become excess, really, really, really top-notch duty, because the chief who sent me up there could not pull me back, because all of a sudden I'm only working 4 days a week and everybody else is doing their full duty time. So Mrs. Rule then said, "Brought my wife in." So then we did that. So then I got out of the Navy, because the captain was going to go to another station, and he offered me to go with him, and be upgraded so he could take me with him. He could take me because he was the CEO. I said, "No, I don't think so. I think I just go home." You know, so that's what happened. We wound up in Everett here, and couldn't find a place to work for a long time. So then I went by Sevenick. Sevenick was the one that owned the Chevrolet garage. And I started to work. I went in there every day. Every day I went to him. I got a job. I need a job. I haven't got nothing. So one day I walked down the alley, and there I looked up, and there all these blackberry vines was up on the side of the building there. So I went in the next morning. He was gone. Went in the next morning. He said, "I thought I told you I don't have no job." I said, "Well, you got one." I said, "What? I found one." He said, "What'd you find?" I told him. We went out in the alley, and I said, "See all them blackberry vines out there? Your building looked nice and front in the front, but look at the back." He said, "Well, okay." I said, "But I ain't got no way. I haven't got no way to haul them." He said, "That's all right. You cut them." And at that time, the dump was down there where you could burn stuff. And he said, "You take my truck, and then you take it down there." So they did that. So I worked myself through that, and I worked for him to the point that I was one of the first black service managers on the West Coast in a Chevrolet garage. I was a service manager for Chevy Chevrolet there for about 10 or 12 years. And so that was kind of, and then that began to foster where we're at and how we began to move into Everett, because at that point in time, then I bought a house. But so the real estate company would not sell to us, only it down there off of Payne Field down there by the car wash back in there. That's the only place you could find. They wouldn't sell you no place else. So we went out, and since I had working for Sevenick, I was doing a lot of caring for parties and stuff, and from the people downtown, because Sevenick was one of the really hefty businessmen here, so he knew all the bankers and lawyers and doctors and that. So, and he got me into just doing parties for people, you know, because I knew how to handle people, and I got to the point that I was good enough that you came in one, and I saw you one time. You had a drink. When you walked in the door, it's in different parties. When I walk up to get your coat, at the same time I have you your drink, because I knew what you drank and that. So I began to work with people that way. So then that gave me an opportunity to continue, because when it come time for me to get the house there, my wife and I went out and seen it at night. And the lady said they would sell to us. So we went to the bank the next morning, because I knew the banker, and told him what was going on. So he called the lady up and said, "Well, Gibson want to buy the house. You going to sell it to him?" She said, "Yeah, we'll sell it to him." So he asked her, said, "Where you check? You don't bank with us, but I'll put this. You can start banking with me now, and I'll put this in your account." And so he did. And so that sealed the deal, because the lawyers and stuff was upstairs. So the deal was settled for us.
Well, let me just interrupt you just for a moment, because I want to jump back to that. But I want to go back to something that you said earlier. Your duty station was Whidbey Island Naval Air Station, but you said that the closest place you could find a place to live was Everett.
Everett.
Was that because you could not get a place to live because you were black?
Yes, that's it. It was only one black person beyond Mount Vernon, and he worked in Mount Vernon at Mount Vernon Chevrolet, and he was the only black person that was beyond the city of Everett.
So despite the fact you were in military uniform,
it made no difference.
It make a difference.
You couldn't get into Anacortes, and you couldn't get into Mount Vernon.
We're talking with Carl Gibson this afternoon on Sound Living, and you're welcome to join the conversation at 425-303-9074. So when you came to Everett, you started looking for a place to live. You ended up buying a house on Hoyt Avenue.
Yes.
Do you remember how much you paid for it?
$9,000.
$9,000. Mm-hmm. This was in 1953 or 54, something like that?
Yeah.
You were the first and the only black family on Hoyt Avenue.
That's right. Was the only one there. I considered it to become the ghetto because there was two other families moved into the same block. So that's the ghetto of North Everett at that time.
You still live in that house?
I still live there.
You still have in that house.
Yeah, yeah.
What was, did you receive negative responses from you moving into, what was Everett like in the mid-1950s for a black family living here?
It was very tough because there was people who were working, worked at the mills. You know, there was no, one worked a couple ways, one worked at the bank and another one worked at the car shop. And there was no place for people to work except the mills and do mundane kinds of things at that point in time. There was nothing. You didn't see anybody downtown in any of the shops working and things like that because there was not enough black folks in town to the people who had the shops to want to patronize anybody else because there was not that many of us in town, you know. See, so that's what it was.
Where did you get the courage to do it?
Well,
was that your grandfather again?
Go back to my grandfather. You know, that had that courage, and you know, I moved on from that shop working for Sevenick. That I then got in. I owned three businesses in town one time. I slept in my truck because I owned a service station, a used car lot, and a tavern. So I slept in my truck, going from business to business because it was giving people a chance to have some place to go.
You couldn't have been always in your truck because you did end up having three children.
That's right.
How did you maintain positive attitude in the face of that kind of sense of you don't belong here? Why are you living here?
The thing that caused my wife and I to be dedicated to Everett, we were dedicated to our three sons because we decided that our kids had to have a college education. Neither one of us had a college education. We both had just high school degrees. And so in order to be able to do that, that means then that you got to get out and you got to work harder and smarter because you got two sons now, and then you got a third one on the way. And so then our whole life had been that our kids had to do better than we did. And so we were fortunate enough to know that all three of our kids had college education, you know, because we worked hard at that. And my kids turned out to be good men. What I mean by that, they worked for a living, they went to college and they got degrees, and they worked in the system like everybody else did, you know. So I feel that my wife and I were married for 65 years, but she passed a couple of 3 years ago. But our whole thing was to make sure that our family got a good education. We came out of the South with that in mind, that we didn't want our kids raised in the situation that we were raised in. So if there's a chance for them to do better, then we got to find that chance and place to do better. Now, why Everett? Everett didn't have that many black folks in there when we came in. I think there must have been about five or six that owned homes, you know. And so the opportunity was there. All we had to do is put our stake in the ground and climb the ladder from there. And
what about for your sons, though? They would have been at just the right age in the as the 50s were turning into the 60s, mm-hmm. and the civil rights movement was just coming to the fore.
Right.
The anti-Vietnam War was just coming to the fore. They would have been in just that right age. Was there a temptation on their part to become radical, maybe go to the South and become part of the Freedom Riders or part of the voter registration?
No, because the fact that we had taught them that there was nobody else any better than you. So they didn't have to go looking at some place to make it better, because they were taught that they were just as good as anybody else. You hold your head up high and you get your education so that you then can face the world with your family like we had to face it with ours. So we've done what we could to make a better place for you. And so that's the way they were raised.
And were they, though, socially, civilly active in that time when the civil rights movement was just beginning to, and as it crested in the mid-60s into the 68, 69?
No, because they were in that, but they were not into that because the fact that they were not taught that they needed to do that. So they didn't have to get out and march and do those kinds of things. They were taught that you keep your head to your heart and your head together, and you move into the situation. You move into the situation. This is where you're living it now. You're living in a world now, in a place now where you are the same as everybody else. So you don't go to Seattle and any place else. You walk downtown Everett here. You're as good as anybody else, and you need to know that, and that's the way we taught them, you know, that you don't have to look sideways at nobody because you go to school. You'll be nice, and you, because you're a part of this community, and that's the way that's what we're working for.
I hate to use the word advantage, but was there an advantage to the fact that most of the attention, most of the concern was in Seattle and Tacoma, mm-hmm. and sort of bypassed Everett because it were sort of a backwater to Seattle?
Well, they're kind of a backwater for Seattle, but, you know, there was a few people here who tried to talk about we need to do a better job, but my family was never into that. I always told them when they're coming in, they come in from Seattle, a place like that, we will take care what we need to take care here, doing it with the people here. We don't need people from the outside to come in and tell us what we need to do. But now, I'm sure that there's some things in Everett now that is not too well, as I can hear from people who are working in different places. I see things in the paper and stuff like that where some of the kids are still having a hard time. But during my kids' time, they were not in that situation. My son works for the city. You know, I think he got about 40 people on him, you know. He worked his way up there, you know. And so, but he worked his way there. He didn't get there by osmosis. He got there because he knew how, what to do and how to do the job. So that's the way he's taught. So as I've been told from some of the people that I see that works for him, they think that he's the finest person that they've had to work with. And that sounds good to me, but, you know, I don't work for him, but I do hear people say that, and I appreciate that.
You had the start of a political dynasty because you had one son who was on the city council in Breyer and a son in the city council in Everett. So there was a movement toward a Gibson dynasty.
Yeah.
Talking with Carl Gibson, who spent 24 years as an elected official, 24 years on the Everett City Council, working under five different mayors. First elected to the city council in 1971 and elected back to office and spent 24 years on the Everett City Council. Let's go back to, let's call it 1969, 1970. We don't want to forget that it was about 1970 that the economy in this area really tanked because Boeing cut the funding off entirely for the SST, the supersonic transport, and that just really wrenched the economy. Did you see that as an opportunity to get into politics because nobody else wanted to do it? Was there an issue that you, as a citizen of Everett, felt needed to be addressed, which is why you decided to run for political office?
No, excuse me. At that time, I was just a worker, and I wasn't involved, didn't think nothing about politics because I didn't figure that anything that I could do contribute to politics. But in 1970...
You're smiling.
1970, when you said to me about getting into politics, I owned a service station at 26 and Kobe up there on the corner at that time. And there was a church right across the street from there. So I said to one of my friends, I said, hold it. The election was the last day of sign up. So I told my friend, I said, well, I'm going to go up and put my name on the list to run for office. I said, you know, I won't make it because I don't have no money and I don't have the popularity that I need. But if I put my name on there, at least I would get some advertisement for my station.
You were an early Mike the Mover.
That's right. So I went up and put my name on the list, and the guy who was waiting, holding my station until he come back, he worked at the post office. His name was David Crockett. And he said, I came in, he said, who did you sign up to run against? I said, Vognell, Larry Vognell's father. He said, what the heck can you do that? We can't win him. I said, well, it was nobody else had signed up when I was there. So I put my name against him. So at least I'll be in the runoff. You know, I'm not going to win, but I'll be in the runoff. So by that time, the paper came out the next morning. There were seven people. And so I...
For that one seat.
For that one seat. But across the street there, the church was there. And the ladies go in there a couple, three times a week. And I owned a service station there, and I had a parking lot. So I let the ladies come in there, and they didn't have to park on the street. I said, all you got to do is leave your keys with me so that I can move your car because I have people paid to park here. But this open space here, I can park and move your cars around. So I did that. And so then I said, well, I don't have no money. So they said, you running? Yeah. So they started bringing in cookies and cakes. And they'd come in for do some things over at the church. They'd bring cookies in I was selling cookies and because they were bringing them in and out, you know. So that's why I got started going. So there was one guy, I went to the printer, and the printer wouldn't let me pay for a batch of, you had to get so many at a time. So one gentleman said, well, he don't have no money, so don't let me know that he's going to pay the bill. And so I'd come up and I'd get 100 bumper stickers. So my kids would put them on the back of people's cars as they come in, you know. So all of a sudden, every time you look up, there go car gifts down the street, you know. So
that's real grassroots.
Real grassroots. And so that was the way I got started.
So that got you in for the first time.
Mm-hmm.
What brought you back for the next term? And how did your constituency, when you went out doorbelling, react?
I always, when I went to speak with any group or anything, I never had anything on but my coveralls or my jeans, because I was working like the same guy you sent out the door this morning. Yeah, I'm that guy. I'm a working guy. I didn't have no suit on or none of those things, you know. Because I said, I'm the guy you sent out this morning with that bread basket. I'm the guy. You So that was my thing all the way, because I was a working person.
Now, I could imagine, though, that in 68, 69, Everett was pretty much being run by the business community.
Yes.
How did you fit into the guys in the suits?
Well, simply because I working for the 70s, and I'd done all of these parties at the country club and at the houses and wherever they were. So I was the guy with the suit, but it's a different kind of suit. So that was it.
And over the course of the 24 years, what
honesty
was honesty?
Honesty. I was there. There was not another. You can't find a person in my opinion that say tell you that I was not honest, and I tell you what I thought, and I never turned away anybody, but I never did not do what I said I was going to do, and I did the best I could. But in politics, you can only do certain things because you only have certain votes that you can get. But my people always knew that I was fighting for the best, that for Everett, that's best possible.
There must have been times, though, when you were frustrated, when that smile was not quite as real as maybe you would like it to have been. Did you go home and pound your kitchen table and stomp around and rant at the people in City Hall, the people in the businesses, because they weren't seeing things the same way you were seeing them?
No, it's funny that you'd ask that. My thing has always been, even with the people downtown and businessmen or whoever, that I always wanted to make sure that I understood what you were trying to accomplish. In other words, when you came before the city council, I might not vote for you but I did my best to let you know when you were doing things on the council. For coming before the council, I done my best to try to help you to present your image there. Not necessarily want to vote for you, but I wanted to make sure that you didn't leave going unnoticed and nobody to understand what you said. And I would try to lead people through when they're trying to say what they want to say. And although I wasn't going to vote for it, but I would let them know, no, I'm not. This is not trying to vote for you or nothing like that. But I think you need to change your thought and your pitch that you're trying to pose before the council. And so that's been kind of a way that I've done it all the time. So people knew that I was not trying to turn the back on them or not trying to undo something. But always let them know that, look, you're trying to sell something, but you're putting up forth the wrong image and putting it towards the wrong way for the city council to accept it.
We're talking with Carl Gibson this afternoon on Sound Living. All right, now, you're 86 years old. Now you're out of politics. Tell me the truth here, just between you and me. Was there a time when the city was run by a cabal of businessmen who got together behind closed doors at the country club and made decisions that the city council then just approved? Now, this is just between you and me.
Yeah, no, I tried to listen and not let a group of people take charge of what we should be doing. So when we were talking about when Costco first started coming in there, you know, people, and I was chairman of the council at that time, and just give you some thought about how things go. The Silver Lake people out there came to us in droves and droves and droves and droves, but I never did let one of those people not do what they say what they want to say. But knowing that we had people on the council, people on the city, in the city, when I was there, you remembered what they did. Those kids was working for us, and they realized that I believed in them wholeheartedly. So when something like that come to before us, I had my work because I talked to them, and I believed in them, and they believed in me. So that made my job easier. Now, I don't know how it is now, but those kids, when I was there, I didn't never go to behind the mayor's back or anybody else, but I was able to listen to those kids as they was as they were doing their views and stuff like that. Made it easier for me to sit there on the council and sit back and I can ride the horse home.
You worked, you were on the city council under five mayors, going mm-hmm. back to Robert Anderson.
Right.
And one of them, of course, was very only a short time after Robert Anderson resigned. There was a woman who was
Joyce Ebert.
She had about a year, I think.
Right.
Yeah. Which of the mayors was the most fun?
Well, I don't think any of them was a lot of fun because I had to understand what they were doing, and since they had the staff, and I didn't have no staff. Only had a staff was a secretary. That's the only staff we had. And so then that mean that you had to be careful how you work with the staff in order to be able to make yourself pliable to what the mayor's trying to bring forth. Because it went through the mayor first before it came to us, you see. And so then you had to learn how to be trustworthy to the mayor. You had to have gain the trust of the mayor. So that you could go in and talk to his staff, and he not think that you're trying to micromanage. And so that's the key to the whole thing is that the mayor's got the staff. So then you have to be careful that you don't try to micromanage the mayor's staff.
Can I ask you which mayor you liked best?
Well,
either in terms of being able to work with or in terms of being most in agreement with your vision of the city of Everett?
Well, Kinch and I was good because Kinch was on the council. He understood.
He was 90 to 94, I think.
And he understood what the council was up against and what they were trying to do. But you must remember, though, that people on the council always want to be mayors. So that's what happened. And I tried that in 1976. And when I lost, I was saying, good Lord, Lord, you did the best thing for me that you could. Because I didn't have no business up there with that. So actually, that's the only time that I really felt that fortunate that I didn't win.
You were known as a facilitator. You were known as someone who was very good at bringing disparate opinions and groups together. What was one of the more contentious items that you felt that you successfully were able to facilitate an agreement on? The Navy?
The Navy. I was one of the ones who We went to Washington, D.C. lots and lots and lots of times because I wanted the Navy to understand that when you drop the gangplanks in Everett here, that it's a new deal for the city of Everett because Everett is not used to that many minorities. And so when you coming in at the Navy, then you got to be sure that you've done your job so that the city is not feeling put up on because the Navy's here. We want the Navy, but you got to tell the citizens of Everett here that what you're doing and listen to them. So that's right. Otherwise, cause when that gangplank drops down, you don't know what's coming into town, so you don't want the people here to be inundated with all the minorities coming in, and so you have to be sure that you have now put out good newsletters and good news and stuff like that so that people here who live here don't feel put upon.
On quiet Sunday afternoons, do you miss it? Do you wish you were back on the city council? Or are you just happy that you had your 24 years and let somebody else have the responsibility for a while?
It's really good that you say that, but you know, I look back on the 24 years, and I think I've been to the council maybe 3 times since I left, because I did what I needed to do while I was there, and so I didn't need to be out there trying to spread my wings and of what I did and all that. I feel what I did, let it speak for me, and I move on quietly.
And do you does the temptation cross your mind every once in a while to pick up the phone and offer a suggestion to the mayor?
No. No, because I was there. When I was there, the mayors knew me, and I was a good facilitator, and I was honest, and so I don't have to.
Mr. Gibson, thank you for being my guest this afternoon. Thank you. It's been a pleasure talking with you.
Thank you.